Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabideau.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, sweetheart. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. And we get to this time of year. I don't know. I get this feeling that we're approaching the fancy food show, the East Coast variety of it.
Well, it's not coming up till at least 6 weeks away. But
yeah, but it's somehow or other I become more conscious of ingredients and snacks, even things like that. So
yeah,
we have a lot of products, what we're talking about today.
Yeah, we got some good stuff today. Good, some nice short, crisp interviews and some really good products. All of which, of course, we wouldn't be telling you about if we hadn't tried them as well as talked to the people who make them.
Yeah, my favorite. I mean, I loved discovering this Cabot chip.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. Yeah. A young man owns it. I think he's now 20. I think he said he's like 27 years old. Started a business 5 years ago, determined to make the very best. Can we call them tortilla chips? No, they're not really tortilla chips.
Well,
they're sort of snack chips, and they call Cabo after Cabo San Lucas in Mexico. But let's just hear the story from the horse's mouth.
Everyone knows what America needs. America needs yet another snack chip. And 5.5 years ago, Christian decided that that's exactly what needed to be done.
Christian Bunt, right?
Bunty.
Bunty.
Bunty. I wasn't sure about that.
Well, Mr. Bunty, and he calls his
B-U-N-T-E.
Chips, and he calls them Cabo chips. I know, because I listen.
Cabo.
You know, they call
Cabo,
it Cabo.
Like,
is it Cabo?
Cabo, like Cabo San Lucas, Mexico.
Yeah, that's the whole thing.
Right.
Well, you started now. Why don't you give us the story of how you ended up with the company making these snacks?
Okay, well, it all started, I mean, really years ago with Dad growing up. He would always make different nachos and things along those lines. And in 2003, he was fortunate enough to win a fishing tournament in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, which is where our family had vacationed for many years. So we thought we'd take those winnings and do something to kind of give back to the community. So we started this business together down in Cabo San Lucas, and it was the flavor that stuck with our nachos most was like a soy and teriyaki type flavor. So we ended up going our original flavor is seasoned with soy sauce and lime juice. Started the business down there, got into many of the hotels and restaurants. Being the popular vacation spot that it is, generated a lot of interest in the state. And I was a junior in college at the time, and I was studying entrepreneurship and figured this would be a great opportunity for me to develop a business plan to bring this product into the state and consumers all over the U.S.
Now, let's start with this. How many flavors do you have now?
We have 3 flavors now. Our original flavor, like I said, is with the soy sauce and lime juice. And then just last year, we introduced 2 new flavors. One is an organic blue corn. It's seasoned with sea salt and lime juice.
Yes, very good.
And yeah, it's a very clean product. Kind of what differentiates us there is it's really thin and crispy, like a real restaurant-style tortilla chip. You don't get that very often in the big mass-produced blue corn chip. And then we have our chipotle flavor.
Which is our favorite,
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one I like the best. That's a knockout.
Yeah, it's really different from a lot of other chip flavors because, you go to the store and you buy potato chips or tortilla chips, and all they do when you get something that has a flavor on it is throw all this powder on there. And we actually grind real chipotle pepper.
Okay, so you're answering my question is, I'm making no bones about this, I think they are absolutely fabulously delicious, these Cabo chips. And I wanted to know why they tasted so good.
Yeah, I think what really differentiates our product, we're using wholesome, real ingredients, whether it be preservative-free soy sauce on the chipotle flavor, grinding real chipotle peppers into it, not using a chipotle flavoring, using either the best natural or organic corn, just using premium ingredients that
It tastes so good. They taste really wonderfully good and fresh.
Yeah, there's a little trail of them sometimes.
Yes.
we keep all the chips and things like that in a particular corner cupboard, and sometimes the person who was in there last leaves a little trail on the ground. can't imagine who that would be.
But they taste authentic, real and authentic.
Is it indeed a tortilla chip? Is it a natural phenomenon? I mean, is it a piece of Mexican food, or did Frito-Lay just invent it?
Since I've been in this industry, I've tried to get to the to the bottom of this. Word on, I think the most I hear is that it was actually invented in U.S. as a way to use up old tortillas.
Uh-huh.
I think that's the story I hear the most.
So it's sort of recycling on a major scale.
Yeah, exactly. There's just, I guess, you know, entrepreneurs and restaurants trying to be resourceful.
You have a website, which is cabofoods.com. Do you have a store finder on that website?
We do have a basic store finder on that website. Our new website will be launching hopefully next week, which will have a more advanced one. And then you can also find our stores on our Facebook as well if anybody wants to visit that. Facebook.com/CaboChips.
Okay, and do you fill orders online?
We do web orders online, and we also are on Amazon as well. Two different. So if you're a regular Amazon consumer, that's probably the easiest way. Otherwise, we order through our website as well.
Now, tell me this. Is this it, or are you constantly thinking of new flavors to add?
We're always working on new flavors. Our goal is to try and introduce a new flavor every year, you know, something exciting for the brand. But the problem is we really have high standards for our product, so we don't always get that new flavor out. And
well, what are you thinking about now? What are you looking at?
Right now we're looking at something be more of like a jalapeno flavor, because the chipotle is a bit smokier. Which I really enjoy, but a lot of comments we get are people just kind of want that heat of a jalapeno without the extra smokiness, and so that's something we're working on.
And you are going to stick with the chips themselves. You're not doing salsas or anything like that, because that's different, right?
Right now we're just sticking with the chips. You know, eventually we could look into salsas, but we want to focus on one thing and do it well, and then can go from there as time and as our growth permits.
Now, are you still making them in the same place, or did you move the manufacturing to?
We do have manufacturing here in the States now for all of the product that is sold in the U.S.
And but you can also get them in Mexico too, I guess.
You can. They are mostly just in Cabo San Lucas.
Okay, all right.
Still in Mexico, but in the U.S., all of our product is made actually here in the same facility where I work and have my office in Southern California.
Right. Well, you did well, Christian, and keep those flavors coming, because they're really good.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
What about that? A 100% endorsement from a lady with fine taste buds.
Thank you so much.
Don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And welcome back. Now, I must say that probably among the top things you crave in the world, you may not have a favorite sauerkraut, but I happen to love sauerkraut, and we just found this wonderful new operation of a variety of sauerkrauts that are artisanally produced, and I learned a lot about it, so let's listen. Well, talking to Catherine Lucas, I've learned a lot about sauerkraut, which I didn't know before. Tell us, first of all, the name of your company, Farmhouse Culture. Is there a significance to the name?
Oh, wow, that's a good question that nobody ever asks me. Yeah, traditionally, farmhouses around the world were the center of activity after a harvest. It's where we'd preserve our food. And so traditionally, sauerkraut was made in and around a farmhouse and then stored in the cellar. And then culture is kind of a play on words, because culturally speaking, it was an important food traditionally through the ages. But interestingly, it's also a cultured vegetable because of the bacteria, the type of fermentation. It's considered to be a cultured food, much like yogurt, for instance. Play on words.
Yeah, it's a double play on words.
That, yeah.
So sauerkraut started out as a way of preserving a surplus of cabbage. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's right. Genghis Khan was thought to be the one who introduced fermented cabbage to to the Central Steppes in Russia, what is now Russia and Poland and those countries now. Yeah. And
what a rich history, huh?
Yeah, very, very much so. The Chinese seem to be the first to fermented vegetables, figured out how to store them.
Wow. It is an obvious question. I mean, how did a nice girl like you end up in California making sauerkraut?
Yeah, well, when I came home from Germany in 1998 and really wasn't sure what I was going to do and waited a couple years, my son graduated high school, and I went back to school myself and wrote a thesis on pre-corporate food traditions, and I also studied natural culinary techniques and went through a natural chef program. And those two activities sort of created sauerkraut in my life. I learned how to ferment at school, and they didn't really seem to know what they were doing, to be honest. So I went home and started sort of applying the knowledge that I'd learned from cooking for so many years, how to fuse flavors together and that sort of thing, and started making what I thought were more sort of gourmet sauerkrauts rather than sort of medicinal sauerkraut. Some of the sauerkrauts on the market tend to be lots of ingredients in them that are good for you but not necessarily taste that great. And so I really wanted to create something that reflected California's region, because traditionally foods reflected our region. We couldn't just pick up the phone and call somebody and have food shipped from all over the world, ingredients shipped up from all over the world to create our dishes. And so as I studied sauerkrauts in through my work on traditional foods in Europe and in Asia, it was really interesting how each village had its own sort of recipe that they were very, very proud of. And I thought, wow, sauerkraut could do very well here in California, although we don't need to preserve our food for months at a time like you do in maybe a colder climate. Cabbage grows beautifully here. We can grow it essentially year-round, and it seemed to be also a pretty easy place to ferment the cabbage in terms of temperature. And so it just kind of got my juices flowing, and I started experimenting with flavors and just fell in love with it.
Well, I think it's just absolutely fabulous stuff.
I mean, thank you.
The one is kind of fierce, the jalapeno one, but I really got used to that one too. I mean, I really love it. It would be great on a Reuben.
Yes, yeah, it really spices a Reuben up.
Oh, yeah. Now, how many different flavors do you have?
Well, we have three that are always constant, and then we have seasonal flavors that come in and out. We've got the horseradish leek, the smoked jalapeno, and the classic caraway. Those are our three standards. And then we have an apple fennel sauerkraut that was inspired by a Russian recipe. Got me thinking about how to play with the ingredient, those ingredients, and it's a top seller for us. But it's a fall kraut. And then we also do a garlic dill pickle kraut in the summer months, and that's a kraut that tastes just like pickles. We call it gateway kraut for people who are not quite comfortable with sauerkraut but love pickles. This seems to be a good entry kraut for them.
And that's seasonal because the cucumbers become available at that time?
That's correct. And particularly the pickling cucumbers with the very high tannins in the skins, they seem to make much better kraut than, say, if I were just to use maybe a hothouse cucumber. So that's why we just stick to the pickling cucumber season.
You know, I've always been a little bit uncomfortable with these crocks, sauerkraut fermenting, where it gets like mold on the top.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And what is that? I mean, do you scoop it off, or what do you do?
Yeah, it's uncomfortable for most of us growing up in this country. I certainly never experienced foods like that. And you go to Europe, and you see all kinds of strange things, and same in Asia, with molds and yeast. So it was a little hard to get used to. But once you understand what's going on with the chemistry, it's a lot more accessible. And so, yeah, on top, what's growing is called a kame yeast, K-A-H-M, and it's a harmless white yeast that's bitter when you taste it, and it's always good to scrape the top couple of inches off of your crock of kraut. And in the old days, they used to cover a wood board with a piece of linen, and the linen would attract the kame yeast, and then they would take that off once a week, rinse out the linen, wrap the board again, and put the weights on top of it and let that linen continue to catch the yeasts and sometimes mold. But if you dig down just a couple inches, you've got perfectly delicious preserved sauerkraut.
Now, if I'm thinking about this from a sauerkraut from a chemical production standpoint, I guess, it's not cooked, right? It just sort of sits there in brine, and then the natural yeasts in the air go to work. Is that how it works?
Well, almost. It's a bacteria process, and actually we're working against yeast. We don't want yeast in our kraut, and like beer and wine rely on yeast, and we're kind of the opposite. This is called a lactic acid fermentation, and lactic acid is present on a lot of vegetables and fruits, but particularly high in cabbage.
Oh, I see. Okay, so that's the thing that does the work comes from. It actually comes with the cabbage.
Comes with the cabbage and a lot of the vegetables, and when you salt the cabbage, a lot of the bacteria and yeast that would like to live in that environment no longer can. They die off, and the lactic acid bacteria can tolerate salt, actually like salt. And so those bacteria start to thrive and take over and kill the others, and they, as they digest the sugars in the cabbage, they are, their byproducts are carbon dioxide, which they're off-gassing. Sometimes crowd will get a little bubbly.
Which is why you and I had that conversation, because I was afraid of anaerobic, you know, whatever it was.
Right, that could cause botulism and that sort of
botulism
thing.
Botulism.
That's exactly right. And so, yeah, off-gases carbon dioxide, and then also spits out an acidic, more acidic bacteria. And so this the acidity continues to rise until, 3.6, 3.5 acidity on the pH scale. And it creates such an acidic environment that nothing else can live in it. And very, very few things can live in it. And it's also what creates the sour flavor.
Right.
And it'll last. Some people think kraut's better after it's been sitting around for a year.
Well, I heard that it's a living thing and actually continues to live and develop until you digest it.
That's right, exactly right.
And that's why it's good for you.
That's it. And it goes to work in your digestive system and joins the colonies of the good bacteria that keep you healthy.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
so it really is healthy.
Yeah, it's one of the healthiest foods I think you can eat.
I love it, absolutely love it.
It's consistently on the top, you know, healthiest food lists.
It's one of the few things I end up craving if I haven't had it for a while. It's strange.
Yeah, it's interesting. The salty and the sour, a lot of us crave.
Yeah, it's really curious how the contents of the jar keep on going down.
I thought that was
it's
gone.
Really, it's really the strangest thing. You know, I sort of take a spoonful, and then it's sort of like there's a Mr. Nobody around who's sneaking in there taking some more. Maybe it just naturally shrinks over time.
It must be something I'm not aware of, but yeah.
Now, Catherine, you don't sterilize the jars then when you can this, right?
We sterilize the jars and then we fill them with the product and put the lid on, but we don't then pasteurize.
Okay.
We don't
because
keep the,
kill this.
Well, you don't want to kill the kraut, right?
That's correct. Traditionally, that's what we know in the state. We know pasteurized sauerkraut, and it's kind of a different product altogether. You've probably noticed.
Yes.
Fresh krauts are a lot crunchier tasting, and there's just something about them you can't put your finger on that you really like. And,
oh, yeah.
And, of course, the flavors tend to stay, I think, more true and accurate to their original flavors, and which are, I think, more interesting and complex.
But this, I mean, I've gotten this kind of kraut before, but in farmers markets, you don't really see it in any supermarket.
Have you gotten it in, for instance, have you gotten it in Munich or any of the markets in Vienna? Or
for a long time, because we haven't been there for a long time.
Yeah, no,
I got the last batch in January in Sanibel, Florida.
Oh, a fresh.
Oh, that's right. The guy was making it.
He had
a
stand, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I was so inspired by, like, the Nachtmarkt in Vienna and the markets in Munich. So we actually sell our product at 10 farmers markets in the Bay Area every week, and we sell out of barrels. And we pack right in front of the customer into these compostable containers. And we also have crocks, ceramic crocks, that we sell to customers, and they bring them back and we refill them every week.
Oh, no, that's a good idea.
Now, how about for listeners across a wider area? You mail this product. You are online. People can place orders.
Yes, we have. We sell our product through Foodzie, Foodzie.
Okay,
and,
great.
And we do have customers from all around the country who order our product that way. But currently, we're in stores in Northern and Southern California.
But Foodzie will do fulfillment across the country.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I mean, you were saying you were in your office now. I mean, give me some idea of the quantity. And how big your facility?
Well, let's see. Our kitchen's about 2,400 square feet, and now we've got about 3,000 pounds of cabbage sitting out. And I can see through my window here that we're going to process tomorrow. It just arrived. And we tend to process about 3,000 pounds a week.
Wow, that's a big operation.
So that's like a ton and a quarter of cabbage.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a lot of cabbage.
Yeah, we anticipate that rising significantly because we've just gotten into the Southern California market, and there seems to be a big demand down there.
Oh, I think it's great. It's an absolutely fascinating story, and listeners, this is a product that is really fine. So if you're a kraut fan but you never tried a natural, what do we call it, unpasteurized sauerkraut?
This is
you just have to get some. Farmhouse Culture is the website. Foodsy is how you get fulfillment if you're not close enough to get some.
Yeah, but they should go on the website just to read about it.
Oh, absolutely. It's a fascinating story, and we're so glad you had the opportunity to share it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
If you have new flavors coming on, let us know. I mean, that's so exciting. I'm very excited for your success.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Stay with us, and we'll talk to you some more on the other side of the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And we're venturing along further into the snack department with an extraordinary cookie first, followed by a very healthful fruit snack, freeze-dried fruit. Let's listen first to Java Bites and second to Fruitzio.
You had trouble pronouncing that one, didn't you?
Well, no. I mean, there are two companies, Crispy
something or other
and Fruitzio.
Krispy Kreme and Fruitzio, but don't forget the Java Bites first. They're the ones we ate first. We're still consuming
you
the others
them.
A little bit at a time. Yeah, there's still a couple left if you want them.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's just a couple left if you want them, but they are the kind of thing you almost can't resist with a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, and that has proven to be the case with us.
Tara Branham is a woman of many talents, and we've just been enjoying one of those many talents in the form of Java Bites, her special cookies, which she's going to tell us about. Tara heads a company called Stir Crazy Creations, and you're going to tell us about that too, Tara, right?
Yes, I will.
Because I wasn't sure the connection between Stir Crazy Creations as the name of a company and the product that I have, which is Java Bites.
So why don't you explain?
Well, I started Stir Crazy Creations in the fall of 2009 with all intentions of providing a all-natural caramel sauce. And as I started developing the sauce, I realized I needed to also have a syrup that we can use in coffee. So as I began the journey, things started to progress, and I had the opportunity to manufacture the Java Bites espresso cookies, and I figured, you know, what a better match. Cookies as well as caramel syrups for your coffee, and that's how it all began.
And somehow the Java Bites got to the front?
Yes.
So the sauces are still to come?
Yes. I should be finalizing the formulas in the next couple months and hopefully rolling some of that out in the next year.
Now, it takes a while when you're doing this sort of only part-time, right?
Yes.
Because I was watching this HBO series last night called Mildred Pierce.
Uh-huh.
And Mildred Pierce became a waitress, but she made herself famous by making pies in her spare time. So you must know all about her story and what hard work it is.
It is a lot of hard work. A lot of things that I did not foresee happening, packaging and UPC codes and, you know, shelf life and having things tested. And so it's a long process, but I've learned an awful lot in the last 12 months.
Packaging.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking at your packaging. It opens up to be a cup, right?
Yes.
Did you know that, Robert?
No, I didn't. Well, I mean, I know you can open the top.
No. Look at the handle on the side of the cup.
Oh, yeah, okay, yes. Okay, I see that now.
But he's just been eating the cookies.
I was more interested in the deal of, you're not still making these at home, are you?
No,
okay.
I actually do have a facility.
Because Mildred Pierce was making 35 pies a night at home.
Oh, no, I have a facility. Typically, we've got it down to, from the mixing all the way to the packaging, we've got it down to about 7 hours, and with two of us, we can do about 12,000 cookies.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow, that many.
That's a lot of cookies. So you're still actually making them, you're just not making them at home.
Correct.
Wow, that's amazing.
I touch every single box.
Oh, that's absolutely amazing. Now, there are a variety of different flavors, but there's a sort of a limited palette surrounding things that go with coffee. Can you perhaps explain?
Well, Well, we have a lot of coffee lovers, and the thought process with the cookies were to, let's create a cookie that tastes like coffee. It's not as hard as biscotti, so you can either eat it alone or you can actually dunk it in your coffee. I do have customers that dip it into their milk and even hot chocolate. But the whole thing was is that, hey, instead of having to take a cup of coffee with us, let's create a snack that we can take with us that tastes like coffee, and you still get that little oomph that will get you down the road.
Yeah, I have a system myself for eating them. I get a little package.
Uh-huh.
And before I tear open the cellophane package, I crack the cookies inside.
Uh-huh.
Because you have to be careful, otherwise you make a lot of crumbs. So you want it broken up so that you can fish the cookie a piece at a time out of the cellophane. I mean, that's why they're designed that way, isn't it?
Well, kind of. We also use them for a base for tiramisu. When we end up actually crushing the cookies in our machine, every once in a while we can't package them. If they get crushed in the machine, we take those and we put them and use them as a base for desserts.
Oh, there you go. So uh-huh. so not a single crumb is wasted, huh?
No.
I like that idea.
And Tara, this product is clearly a springboard to other products, but you have started out with, is it five basic flavors?
Yes.
And what are they?
We have the almond mocha, and that is an almond and mocha cookie with espresso bits and milk chocolate chip. We also have a cinnamon cappuccino, and that's kind of a blast of a snickerdoodle, vanilla cinnamon cookie with espresso bits and chocolate chips. We have a chocolate chip espresso, and that's just a classic with a kick. It's a crunchy chocolate chip cookie with espresso chip. And then we have our best seller, which is our white chocolate vanilla latte, and that's our signature cookie. It's a buttery cookie with creamy white chocolate and espresso bits. And then last but least, we have the white chocolate mocha latte, which is a chocolate lover's favorite. This is a buttery chocolate mocha cookie filled with white chocolate chips and espresso bits.
Now, the only important thing left we have to investigate is where people can get their hands on these.
You can go to our website at www.javabytes.com. We are also on amazon.com. And we're starting to move to your local coffee shops.
Great. So that's going to start moving sort of away, first of all, from geographically where you are and then expanding from there?
Yes. Yes. We actually have some places in Louisiana, Tennessee, and places like that. So.
Great. Well, we wish you every success. We hope that you manage to place your products in Whole Foods and supermarkets around the country.
And to keep new products coming, too, because we want to get those sauces out.
Well, the caramel sauces are coming soon, right? You said by the end of the year, I think.
I'm hoping to have them done by the end of the year. I'll finish up the development piece, hopefully, in the next couple months.
Well, we wish you every success, and it's been just a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Tara. Angela Liu is the founder and the CEO of a company called Crispy Green. Welcome to On The Menu, Angela.
Thank you very much, Ann.
You started out interested and passionate about food, particularly healthy food, but what propelled you to move from the corporate world into designing your nutritious snack?
Okay. I always have a personal philosophy about eating good food, and food has to be taste good and good for you. And I grew up in a culture that fruit and vegetable are just essential part of daily diet. So I worked in pharmaceutical industry as a research chemist for over 15 years, and I spent a whole lot of time in research finding drugs to treat obesity, diabetic, all the metabolic conditions. And I learned through my study and research that there's just no magic bullets for this very complicated health conditions. So the best way to prevent getting into these problems is adjusting your diet and eating healthier food. So in 2004, I got this opportunity because of the corporate merger and acquisition, decided it's time for me to move on and take a good service package and try my passion, which is in the food business and also eating healthy. I explored different opportunities, and I finally got this very niche idea of creating a healthy snack using this technology called freeze drying.
Now, the company is called Crispy Green, but you have two lines of products, don't you?
Correct, yes.
Do you want to explain what they are?
So, yes, we have Crispy Green because the company founded it with a company named Crispy Green. So, I started with the line of product called Crispy Green using 100% freeze-dried fruit, high-premium freeze-dried fruit product, single ingredient, there's no additive, no preservative, just the fruit itself, nothing else. And we had that product for several years. It's been doing really well. We're adding different flavors of fruit into this Crispy Green line. We, at this point, have apples, Asian pears, bananas, mangoes, and pineapple. So after several years of selling Crispy Green, we saw that their customer wanted to have a different variety of fruit. So last year, we added the line called Fruit Seal. Fruit Seal is just a way that to expand the variety of product we offer. Fruit Seal line of product is also premium freeze-dried fruit, but with hints of sugar added to the product just to balance the variation in sugar contents of the fruit throughout the year. So in the Fruit Seal line, we have strawberry, we have peach, apricot.
Kiwi.
The latest one is kiwi, which is a sensation. It's very, very good selling and getting a lot of good review on the kiwi.
That's really a very successful product, that one.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Have tried it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I've tried it mostly.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
I'm the one called Mikey. You can give it to Mikey. Mikey eats everything. But
so you're the Mikey of the family.
But it's a lovely product to eat, and it's a beautiful package. The interesting thing is that the little pieces of freeze-dried fruit, I hate to say this, but they're actually not very attractive.
the parent of freeze-dried fruit
they taste fabulous. They taste absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, the strawberries look particularly unattractive. I don't know why. The visual appeal, right?
That's fruit, as you know, that the appeals of their parents always get pretty badly destroyed for most part.
Right.
I would say that, you know, compared to other way of drying, either dehydration by evaporation or other kind of heat dry, sun dry, freeze dries actually preserve its shape and the coloration of the fruit and also the micronutrient the best way. It is much more true to its nature sort of way of drying. And in addition to that, freeze drying has another benefit, which is remove almost 100% of water. There's no other way that you can achieve that kind of water reduction in product like fruit. And in the meanwhile, while you're doing this water reduction or removal, is done in such a low temperature that actually greatly preserve the integrity, the shape, the texture, the composition of the material. So that's why, you know, freeze-dried food has such a nutritional benefit as well as its other attractive feature.
Now, you call it freeze-drying, and it seems like if you freeze something, then that would mean it would have to stay frozen in order to be good. But that's really not true. The product of the freeze-drying is actually a shelf-stable, room-temperature product, correct?
Correct. It's actually a dry product. It's not when you have a product that's freeze without actually remove the water, then you really need to keep it in a low temperature to preserve it. So the water actually does as the media to spoil a lot of fruit. Food product. But in this case, freeze drying is really just the process of drying the food. It's not really a way to preserve the product. Freeze drying is really a process to remove water from, in this case, fresh fruit in a very cold condition and with vacuum condition and leaving behind the true essence, you know, including the taste, the nutrient, fruit. Everything else, you know, that everything else is pretty much intact except for the water part. So once the water is gone, then the product is very stable. All bacterial microorganisms require water to thrive, to live. So when you got water completely removed from the fruit product, it can be shelf-stable for for a long time. That's why this is the process they actually use for many years before it become a commercial process. They use this to dry food for the astronauts. That's why some people know that freeze-dry ice cream long time ago is exactly the same principle, same process. But now and more you see this freeze-drying is applying to commercial food production, food process, because it's become much more amenable to large-scale manufacturing process.
How did you figure out how to do this? You were a research scientist working with pharmaceuticals, but it's not quite the same thing as freeze-drying things, is it?
Well, actually, this is exactly my background leading me to this business, because in pharmaceutical industry, we use freeze-drying. The technical term is called lyophilization to prepare pharmaceutical products.
Oh, I see.
That's exactly because freeze-drying is such a good technique to preserve the chemical integrity of pharmaceuticals. So it's very widely as a technique to remove water. And then, you compound, you dry the medicine into powder, and then the further compound into medicine. So I know this technology very well through my years working as a chemist.
So it was sort of a natural thing. Now, was it?
Exactly. It's a natural thing that I understand the technology, and I understand the benefit of this technology and applying this technology. And this led me to, think if we can use this process to dry food product in a large scale to make it into like a commercialable product, and this must have a good potential for marketing because in many ways it provides such a good benefit to the end product compared to eating other type of food.
Now, is anybody else doing this?
There are a few other companies now on the market has a similar product. We certainly one of the earliest ones to introduce freeze-dried fruit snacks. We very differentiate ourselves by the quality and the taste of the product. Personally, as my, I told you that my personal philosophy always belief, good food has to have a good taste. Taste is probably the number one important element of any food. If you don't get a good taste for food, and that will never, be a long-lasting product. So that is really a basis of our product development. So we always work with premium, high-quality ingredient to start with the process because the product is so simple. So all the taste of the product, the end product, it comes from the original taste of the fruit. So if it doesn't start with the right material, it just end up with, as a garbage in, garbage out, as they say.
Yeah.
So,
where do you get your fruit?
We got our fruit. We sourced most of our fruit in China. We processed the product in China. And we actually have other fruit sourced from other country that we ship to China for the process.
So you're capturing the fruit when it's at the peak of
yes.
its... So you've gone one stage further than Clarence Birdseye.
Yeah, that is actually a huge challenge for us, that when the harvest season, say, for example, apple, between September to December, that time frame, we have to be able to pretty much forecast and project the demand of what we need for the coming years, because we really had to use the fresh produce at that season, at the time, and to start the process. And that's the only way to capture the flavor and the best quality of the fruit.
Now, what's next, if anything, that you can tell us about so our listeners will be ahead of the game?
Boy.
We
have a very close one coming to the Krispy Kreme line of product. For Frisbee, we just launched a kiwi. But certainly, we will have definitely one new addition this summer to Krispy Fruit. So I will not be able to tell you that now, but your listener can just turn into crispygreen.com or our Facebook page to get the latest update. We're expecting to have that new product coming in June.
The website is crispygreen.com?
Crispygreen.com, correct.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's a marvelous story, and Clarence Birdseye would be proud.
Angela, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter and Anne. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Pleasure talking to you. Bye-bye.
Now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And if you think that the products we've talked about up to now are unusual, wait till you hear about Pig of the Month.
Yeah, that, I think, is a Pulitzer Prize-worthy name of a company,
Pig of the Month. It certainly is, and the story of how this business got started and what it's up to, I think you're going to find quite fascinating.
We really enjoyed our barbecued ribs and our pulled pork, especially since we didn't even have to cook them. We're talking to we're talking to Leah Richards, and she has this interesting company called pigofthemonth.com. Tell us, Leah, what was your initial contact with barbecue that makes you so nuts about it?
I have crazy parents. I have parents that are very obsessed foodies, and growing up, when we would go on vacation several times a year, all over the U.S., and it would be like a hunt to find the best barbecue joint.
Oh.
So just had it since an early age, I guess.
But you are in southern Ohio, which does not exactly have a very strong barbecue tradition, does it?
Not historically. You usually think of places like Texas and South Carolina and Memphis, but I feel like, you know, Ohio can be grouped into that. We're right near Kentucky. We're right on the Ohio River. I feel like we're just part of that whole southern culture.
Now, was your father southern, or was he from Dayton, too, or he just liked barbecue?
He is southern. His whole family's from Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, Louisville.
Yeah, so I grew up on a lot of, like, Louisville hot brown sandwiches and stuff.
Well, now, do you have a style of barbecue? Is it like Kentucky style?
We don't do a Kentucky style. There is a Lexington style of barbecue that tends to have like a real vinegary sauce that gets dipped in, yeah. But it's not my favorite. Is it bad to say that?
No, absolutely not. You're supposed to say exactly what the right answer is.
Whatever you feel like. So, but you're young, and you have this entrepreneurial spirit, which has nothing to do with what you're trained to do, but it's something you felt would really fly. Pigs could fly. I had to get that in there. So when did you start this business?
I started it about a year and a half ago. I started after I graduated from college and had taken a job that I really wasn't that fond of. And then I decided to quit and open a barbecue place.
So you actually have a place?
Yeah, we have a big kitchen. It's got like this big custom 14-foot smoker and all the packaging equipment and stuff.
But you don't actually have a restaurant?
You don't have a retail?
No.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that so the people wouldn't immediately start driving towards Dayton, Ohio looking for a sign that says Pig of the Month.
No. We'd be much happier to just send it to you, and you can have it in your own kitchen.
Great. Give us an idea of the range of products you have. This is all pre-cooked stuff, but you also have sauces. Tell us all the stuff you have.
Okay. All right. This is, we have six different styles of slow-cooked smoked ribs. We do two styles of Carolina, Carolina mustard and a Carolina red sauce. We do a Key West in a bottle barbecue sauce and style of ribs. We have a Memphis, we have a Texas, and we have a Hawaiian style rib.
Oh, so you have all those regional things, huh?
Yeah, that's kind of how I like to plan it out. I think they're all like very distinct, and they all need to be represented.
Now, we just got a single shipment, but Pig of the Month sounds like it's like you sign up and you get a regular package. Is that the way it works?
You can do it either way. You can just buy straight off the website whatever you'd like, that one rib, two rib, whatever, pulled pork, or you can actually go ahead and we have our pre-done packages where we'll send you a different flavor of pulled pork or ribs every month.
Now that's cool. That's really cool.
So you don't have to think about it. It arrives on the same day of the month every month.
Right, and it comes with sides and bottles of sauce, and I think it's just like a really good gift.
Oh, I think it's a wonderful gift. We thought it was a wonderful gift. We opened it right away. We ate it for dinner that night and lunch the next day, and it was really good.
Good.
What is your website?
It's pigofthemonth.com.
Okay.
So there was no cyber squatter on Pig of the Month. Nobody thought of it before.
They had, actually. They had. I was so surprised, and I had to pay like $400 to get that from him.
Really?
Yeah. Who would have thought of that?
Who would have thought of that?
Well, it's really funny. You know, when we did research for our own website,
the menu, yeah.
there was a cyber squatter who had onthemenu.com. He's never used it. And since at the time we were both on radio and on the internet, We thought On the Menu Radio sounded like it made sense, and we were delighted to find that .com domain was available. But it's really funny. There are lots and lots of things out there that people already own.
Yeah, they just must sit around thinking of, like, what hasn't been taken? Maybe I should buy it.
Yeah, you wonder why they didn't start a business, because it's such a great name, Pig of the Month Club. Pig of the Month.
It could mean a variety of different things.
That's
totally. And we get some interesting ones. Yeah,
really?
Are you a pig farm? I'm like, no.
We could have MCP of the Month. And at one time was very active making custom jewelry, and for a friend she made a silver pig that must have weighed in about 3 ounces or something like that.
And you
engraved it MCP.
Okay.
That was for Jay.
It's a big hog.
It was a big hog. It bent your neck when you wore it.
Well, now, how big is this company that you're running?
It's actually pretty small. It's really, because our kitchen really isn't that big, and we are very, very efficient at what we do, and there's only 5 of us, including me, and we just all work in the kitchen together and get it all done, and we have 2 people that exclusively do the shipping every single day.
Just for listeners, just so that they know, anywhere in the United States it's overnight shipment?
Yes, we could be anywhere in the United States. You have to pay extra for overnight. 2 days is our standard.
Okay, and 2 days is fine. So nobody should worry about the fact that something's going to happen to spoil what's inside the box.
No, we tested this extensively all over the country to make sure it was good, you know, even to the far reaches of, like, Maine and stuff.
Well, where do you get your pork?
Yeah, it comes out of a smaller farm in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, I knew Cincinnati. I knew Cincinnati was involved there somewhere, so that's the source of the pigs. Okay.
Yeah, they give us their meat. They're a really great local farm.
Uh-huh. Are they, like, good husbandry and everything? Are they natural?
I don't believe they're, like, all organic. I think they use practices that are natural, and they go with the whole animal rights, clean slaughtering of animals. And yeah, because I think that's important.
Yeah, I do, too, so that's great.
And you've got
it tastes good.
And you've got a great product in the pulled pork, so you can use just about every part, right?
Right. Maybe I should start using some pork belly or something, you know?
Oh, yes. I guess, I don't know. Is that still a hot trend, I guess?
Oh, sure it is.
It's good stuff, I guess.
Yeah, there's almost no end to it. Now, you're not doing anything with heads and tails yet, though.
Oh, gosh.
I'd
like to open a box and see a pig head staring at you, you know?
Well, I mean, we've had whole pig's heads at conferences and stuff.
And you can also make things by cooking up the head and then picking out the meat. Now, there's all kinds of things you can do with it, but you don't do that.
Not right now. You never know in the future, though.
Check out the pig's ears. They make a great bar snack.
Pig's ears.
Sure. All
right. It was at least 6 steps to produce a pig's ear that was a bar snack, though. Seemed like a lot of work.
Who did that?
It was a restaurant in New York that had bar in the name, not Bar Baloo, but something similar to that. Down in Greenwich Village was where we had those for the first time.
Oh, yeah?
But they're sort of cooked and then cooked again and then cut up and then refried and then they become bar snacks.
I always think when you say that, I think of, like, the dog treats that, you know, the pig's ears you can buy.
Oh, okay. Well,
there you
go.
That's right. They're dog treats.
Well, you're going the same way, except you're making something edible out of it.
Right.
Human edible. Well, listen, we wish you the best of luck. Yeah, and let us know if you have any plans to diversify.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, Leah, it's been a pleasure meeting you and talking to you and enjoying your product. And
I'm so glad you liked it.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's just such a great concept, too, because nobody has time to do anything anymore. You know,
right, and why not have the best possible thing you could have?
And good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Anne. Bye, Peter.
Stay with us while we take another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, just to stop you from thinking that you can go through life buying things, getting products delivered through the mail, getting prepared snacks and all that kind of thing, the fundamental staff of life, I guess, is what they've always called bread, and a new look on how to make simply great breads from a real expert.
Anybody who hasn't heard of Daniel Leader has not been doing justice to the culinary world in terms of bread particularly and cookbooks, and also outstanding writers. Daniel, welcome to On the Menu. We're looking at, we're looking at your book, which is actually, it's a slim book compared to the, as I told you, I've been getting these, getting hit with these. Now, you have a particular, it's very different, you said, from all your other books. Do you want to just tell our listeners what is different about it and what your purpose is in writing this book?
Well, you know, my other books were a little bit more complicated. Layers of dough and sourdoughs and different types of yeast starters and different type of sourdoughs. And I would get a lot of queries from readers who said, I love your books, but I don't always have enough time to make a 12-hour sourdough or a bread that I have to make overnight. And I would really love to have a collection of recipes, things that you can make in an hour or two. And it seemed over the years I was getting more and more of these letters. And so I decided to put a book together of sweet and savory yeasted treats that are simple, that are straightforward, that are delicious, and that are easy to make.
And that's what you did.
And that's what I did.
And they also happen to be recipes for people's favorite types of breads, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how many times people ask me for a bialy recipe or a babka recipe or a yeasted donut recipe. I mean, people like baking at home. I think that baking is something that is universally appealing. It's like gardening. And not everyone has the time to devote hours and hours and hours to baking. And so these, if I could call them a baker's basket of great recipes, simple great recipes, that's what this book is about.
How did you manage to do that? Was there a new set of techniques that you need to tell people about? Or?
No, these are all simple techniques.
Okay.
They just don't happen to have starters in them and sourdoughs. All of the recipes are very, very straightforward. Something as simple as crumpet or...
Oh, yeah, Peter saw that right away.
Right, or English muffins or a simple brioche.
I have to say, Daniel, most people in the United States don't even know what a crumpet is.
Well, hopefully they will now.
So those little holes that are important, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And so I just tried to put a book together of really user-friendly and also things that don't seem daunting to the average home baker. And in a way, it seemed very simple, like angel biscuits, or I have a recipe for very crisp breadsticks.
I really miss making breadsticks, actually, Grissini.
Yeah, and they're really simple.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. The technique is you cut up the dough with your pasta cutter.
Yeah.
Nothing if not invented, this man.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you make a fairly substantial claim at the end of the introduction to your book, and you say that using this book, you'll be able to make breads that are indistinguishable from artisan breads, but in a fraction of the time.
Absolutely.
That's pretty bold.
Well, you know, if you think about real artisan breads, I mean, or if you look like traditional artisan breads, I mean, what is it about an artisan bread that appeals to people? It's the rugged look, it's the crust, it's the flavor, it's the texture. If you give someone a delicious baguette, they're not so concerned with how it was made as how nice it is to eat. And if you look at these recipes in the book, rustic in character, but they're also very, very simple and delicious at the same time.
But you've done the hard work. You've done the hard work of figuring out what steps are essential and which ones are not essential, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I have this a favorite recipe of mine in the book is a savory yeasted tart with onion confit and olives. And it's a simple yeasted dough with caramelized onions and black olives and a little anchovy. And it's just fabulously delicious. And, it's very rustic looking in character.
You've got monkey bread, caramel monkey bread in here. And I tell you that these, I've told Peter when I was looking at the book before the interview, that I've never understood Parker House rolls. They always look so pale and, when you see them. Yours look good.
Yeah, no, these are very good. I mean, to me, a delicious Parker House roll is a buttery,
tender, rich, delicious, very light roll, something that you might make a turkey sandwich on or something that you just might use in a stew or a soup to mop up the gravy. But, you know, again, it's something that's simple and delicious.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, I guess I'd like crustier breads than that in a way. But, you know, one of the trends I've noticed is that a lot of the contemporary restaurants are eliminating the bread basket. Have you seen that?
Well, I think they're eliminating the bread basket because bread's expensive.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, they're doing it. That's all I'm saying, is because there have been two really very contemporary restaurants that opened recently where people have complained wildly, but it's part of the philosophy of the restaurant, that there's no bread basket.
Yeah, we should give Kevin Sousa this book.
Yeah.
He's one of the culprits. You don't know his name, but he's one of the culprits.
Right. Well, I think some people are doing it just because they don't want the bread, in theory, to interfere with the meal, or I don't understand the logic behind it myself.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think it's a bad idea to fill up on the bread basket when you've ordered an expensive dinner.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be so extreme about it to eliminate it altogether.
Now, I mean, you go back with bread for such a long time, and it was like an unknown in the U.S., like artisanal bread, mm-hmm. when you first started out, and there were no resources. Now, of course, there are plenty. Can you just sort of give a quick overview?
It's interesting because my background is originally as a chef, and when I started, you know, cooking in Europe is when I became exposed to artisan bread bakers. And I met this guy in Paris many years ago, and he said, "Oh, I'm sure bread like this is so popular in the United States." And in fact, it wasn't. And so when I started, you know, it was very hard to find artisan bread baking equipment. It was very hard to find artisan ovens. It was very hard to find flours that were more appropriate to artisan bread baking. And as you said, right now the resources are much broader and much more available. And it is a different world, but at the same time, the artisan bread world has changed again in that a lot of the artisan breads that people buy now are what they call par-baked frozen breads, breads that are made in factories, you know, that look like artisan breads, but they're not made by artisans.
Is that what they do with the poulain breads in France?
Oh, no, the poulain breads, they ship them around the world fresh. That's a different story. But, you know, there are many par-baked frozen bread companies in this country where the bread is half-baked and frozen and sent to the stores, and the stores just warm it up. So you get the illusion of warm bread, but it's not what I would call artisan bread.
Would you see anything new developing in this whole thing? I mean, we've passed the bread machines, I'm hoping.
Oh, no, the bread machines, I think, have come and gone.
Thank you.
I think that as the food revolution continues in this country, and it's very interesting because if you look back, you know, 25 years ago in France, the average farmer's market or the average specialty food store was light years ahead of the average store in this country. And now, in many ways, past and exceeded specialty food stores here are much more elaborate and have a much bigger array of foods. But in terms of breads, I think that you know, the Americans have a taste now for good bread, and I think that there's going to continue to be a growing market for good bread, and that it's up to the bakers to decide how high they want to go. What heights does the average artisan baker want to try to achieve?
Yeah.
But the market's there if you want to go for it.
Yeah. Well, of course we're past Atkins now. We're past that, but now the fastest growing segment of the specialty food market is gluten-free. So do you have gluten-free in here?
No, we don't make gluten-free, and I'm probably the wrong person to ask about gluten-free, but I will say that my company survived the Atkins diet, where everything was, you know, no carbs, you know, lots of protein, no carbs, and I can't imagine that the gluten-free craze is not going to have a short life in the same way that the Atkins diet did.
Yeah, we're not sure which side of the argument we're on. We certainly understand which side of it you're on, and we understand that completely.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, and I'm not saying there isn't anything. Well, I actually have an opinion about where the gluten-free thing came from, and that is that, you know, people in this country have been eating over-refined wheat for a very, very long time. And when you take off the endosperm, and people are eating very, very refined starch in high quantities, I think people's bodies are rebelling.
Okay, yep, yep. Yeah, makes sense.
And so I think that as people continue to strive towards balanced diets, healthy diets, I think that you'll find there'll be a less need for the extreme diets, which would be like gluten-free.
Well, it seems to me that having this book on your cookbook shelf would be a great way to equip yourself for that future. So we thank you so much for producing it. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks, Daniel. So that's all. That's it. Until next week, and we'll say bye-bye.